A final note, David Barsamian of Alternative Radio is in the house. AR has a... Yes. AR has a large collection of Chris Hedges programs, which can be accessed at alternativeradio.org. Recordings of tonight's talk will be available on Monday. So please, if you have any other questions, visit the table at the back where you can speak to David in person. At this time, I will ask that everyone please silence iPhones, Blackberries, anything that will beep, ring, or vibrate during the course of tonight's talk. And now for introductions. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who has reported from more than 50 countries. He spent 15 years at the New York Times as a foreign correspondent and bureau chief. He was a member of the team that won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for the New York Times' coverage of global terrorism, and he received the 2002 Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. He's the author of 12 previous books and is currently a senior fellow at the Nation Institute, as well as a weekly columnist for Truthdig. His work has appeared in Harper's, The New Statesman, The New York Review of Books, The Nation, and other publications. Please join me in welcoming Chris Hedges.
Thank you. So every book that I've written has a kind of template, a book that I've looked to as a model for what I want to try and achieve. When I wrote Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt with the great cartoonist Joe Sacco, we looked back to James Agee and Walker Evans' work, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. That book took us to the poorest pockets of the United States, the sacrifice zones, the places where individuals, families, and communities have been sacrificed by global capitalism. Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States, Pine Ridge, South Dakota, where a male has an average life expectancy of 48, that is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. The coal fields of southern West Virginia, which have been turned into a toxic wasteland, in Immokalee, Florida, where you have conditions, as in our prisons, that can only be described as slavery. We interviewed workers who at night had been chained inside of trucks, undocumented workers. This book was informed by Emile Durkheim's On Suicide, written in 1897. Durkheim, for me, along with W.E.B. Du Bois, is an extremely important sociologist because, like Du Bois, Durkheim spent most of his time conducting interviews and in the field. I mean, when Du Bois writes one of his classic works, The Philadelphia Negro, I think by the time he was done, he had interviewed over 1,250 families in Philadelphia in order to write this work. So it's the marriage of an acute, brilliant mind in the case of both Durkheim and Du Bois, probably our greatest intellectual in America, with rigorous reporting. And as a reporter, as somebody who comes out of the newspaper world, not only do I enjoy reporting and find it interesting and invigorating, but it constantly challenges my assumptions. And however thoughtful and informed you may be, when you walk into the communities that you're writing about, those assumptions are often shattered. I wrote a book on the Christian right 10 years ago called American Fascists, the Christian Right, and the War on America. I was trying to reach out to them. And I come out of the church. My father was a Presbyterian minister. My mother was a seminary graduate and a professor. I graduated from Harvard Divinity School. But I carried the assumptions of, I would say, the Christian left. My father in particular was quite close to the Catholic worker movement. Phil and Dan Berrigan were the heroes in our house, and to this day, the Berrigans remain two of my great heroes. And when I started interviewing, and I was in Colorado for the book, I actually spent an evening with James Dobson, who is as frightening as he appears. But as I carried out interviews, dozens of interviews, I couldn't hear the stories of dislocation and pain, struggles with domestic abuse, sexual abuse, divorce, alcoholism, opioid addiction, underemployment, unemployment, jail, prison time, without it breaking my heart. And I reconfigured the book. I began, the first chapter is despair. And the pain of the people, I think the movement is, I didn't use the word fascist lightly. I think the movement is fascist. I think they are Christian heretics. I think they are an incredibly dangerous political force, and we are watching that force now fill the ideological vacuum of Donald Trump. That's part of the whole Kavanaugh push, is because the Christian right is frantic to get him on the Supreme Court. But nevertheless, the people themselves were worthy of empathy. And I came to the conclusion at the end of that book that the only way to integrate these people who had embraced magical thinking back into the society was to give them economic and social stability, rebuild the social bonds that had been shattered. So this is very much Durkheim's theme. Durkheim, in the book, found that those individuals and groups that, as he writes, had a good balance between individual initiative and communal solidarity had the lowest rates of suicide. And he called this a life-sustaining equilibrium. That equilibrium between the personal and the collective. He said that when those social bonds were broken, it created what he called a state of anomy. And he defined anomy as rulelessness, meaning that the rules no longer work. So the rules of the American myth are that if you work hard, you obey the law, you get an education, you can succeed. There is the possibility of social mobility. In fact, everything now has been inverted, where we have a rapacious oligarchic class which has created social inequality unlike anything we have ever seen in American history, now outstripping even the Gilded Age, who, and Matt Taibbi wrote a good book about this called Divide, who have created a two-tier legal system. So the poorer you are, in essence, we've criminalized poverty. The poorer you are, the more the law extracts from you. So if you go, for instance, in Ferguson, Missouri, those county governments depend on for 30 or 40% of their revenue, because corporations like wealthy individuals no longer pay taxes. Remember, under Eisenhower, the wealthiest corporations and individuals paid 91%. So, and we have some corporations like Bank of America that don't pay any taxes at all. And now with a tax boycott, I mean, it's kind of insane as to what's happened. So, standing on a sidewalk, it's called obstructing pedestrian traffic, carrying an open container, not mowing your lawn. This is actually, you can be fined for this in Ferguson. It's just endless. And so you're extracting more and more from those who have the least, while those who have the most pay less and less and less. And that shatters the social bonds. If you're a poor person and you have a small amount of narcotics, all of your possessions can be seized, and you can be tossed into prison for years. Whereas if you are HBSC, the bank that money laundered $800 million worth of drug cartel money from Central and South America, you pay a small fine and nobody's held accountable. If you are Goldman Sachs and you engage in what is clearly financial fraud, you're bailed out every penny on the dollar. If you have phalanxes of lawyers like Donald Trump, you can get away with anything. If you are poor and you go to court, you won't even get a jury trial. 94% of those within our prison system never went to trial. They're forced to plea out. Durkheim also understood something very important about the nature of capitalism. And he said that to succeed within a capitalist system, you build transactional and temporary relationships. You don't build real, sustained relationships. And I'm not the only person in this room who's worked for a corporation. I work for the New York Times. And you know that false camaraderie of being inside a corporate system. So to prosper within, this is Durkheim, to prosper within a capitalist system, it's antithetical to building the relationships that create the social bonds that make us whole. For those who advance within that system, they do so by being mercenary and manipulative and building hollow and ultimately empty relationships. So Durkheim is coming at alienation from a perspective that's very different from Karl Marx. Marx celebrates alienation as essentially a force that disconnects workers from the means of production, leads them to challenge or question power, and ultimately, in Marx's eyes, leads to resistance and revolt. But for Durkheim, anomie drains us of energy. And we may, for Durkheim, indeed understand what's wrong, but we're paralyzed. And we begin to engage in self-destructive pathologies. And that's the focus of the book, those pathologies. So I spend time with heroin addicts. I spend time with gamblers. I wrote my gambling chapter out of the Trump Taj Mahal before Trump announced. And so by the time I got there, this is in Atlantic City, the Trump Taj had gone through multiple bankruptcies. It was a ruin. There were mold spots in the ceilings, lights were burned out, holes in the carpet. The arena had been shut down. Most of the restaurants had been shut down. And the restaurants that were open, you could see mice and rats periodically scurry across the floor. Most of the rooms were mothballed. They weren't even renting them out. You went into the bathrooms and there was plastic bags over the urinals saying out of order, kind of a metaphor for where Trump's going to lead us. And what I found with gambling, most people who gamble on slots, which turn you into a zombie. And the gambling industry is quite sophisticated in terms of tailoring the environment to suck addicts into that system where they'll sit for 6 or 7 hours. And that I found in the research of the book that actually gambling addicts have the highest rates of attempted suicide of any addict. And they not only fall into bankruptcy and debt, but they often lose their jobs, their houses, and their families. And Trump comes out of that world, preying on people who have deep despair and financial distress. And in that, I think I find a similarity between him and the Christian right. I mean, sometimes I've heard it asked, how can the Christian right support Donald Trump? And I think that is a complete misreading of the Christian right. These people are Christian heretics. You don't have to spend 3 years at Harvard Divinity School, as I did, to understand that Jesus did not come to make us rich. This whole idea of magic Jesus and the prosperity gospel and acculturating the worst aspects of American imperialism and capitalism with the Christian religion, sacralizing essentially these qualities really makes the Christian right a kind of mirror image of the so-called German Christian Church that existed in fascist Germany. One of my great mentor at Harvard Divinity School, James Luther Adams, had been at the University of Heidelberg in 1936 and 1937. He'd actually been in the lecture hall watching Martin Heidegger give the Nazi salute before he began his lectures. And he dropped out and joined the Confessing Church led by Niemöller, Bonhoeffer, Schweitzer, Karl Barth. And he took home movie film of not only the Confessing Church, but the so-called German Christian Church, where on one side of the altar you had the cross and the other side the German swastika. And when I did my course with him, he was then 80 years old, he told us that when we were his age, we would all be fighting the Christian fascists. Because he said, as we deindustrialize the country, as we disenfranchise the working class and push people into despair, the form of American fascism would come with the familiar iconography and language of patriotism and the Christian religion. Robert Paxton actually makes this point in his book, Anatomy of Fascism. So Durkheim understood the danger of anomie, the danger of breaking those social bonds. He writes, "Our actions require an object outside themselves. It is not because we need to sustain the illusion of some impossible immortality. It is because it is implicit in our moral being, and it cannot be lost even partially without that moral being losing its reason for existence. There is no need to demonstrate that in such a state of collapse, the slightest cause for depression can easily give rise to desperate acts. When life is not worth living, everything becomes a pretext for ridding ourselves of it. For individuals are too closely involved in the life of society for it to be sick without their being affected. Its suffering inevitably becomes theirs." That was the start of my book. And I was probably spent 2 years, I was in over 15 states, Utah, California, Indiana, Illinois, Pennsylvania. I opened the book in Scranton, Pennsylvania, to look at these self-destructive pathologies that are now playing out across the American landscape. Pathologies born out of the destruction of social bonds and the anomie that has gripped most of the American public. And the argument in the book is that only when we address that anomie, only when we reconstruct those social bonds, will we be able to thwart the very frightening corporate totalitarianism and potentially Christian fascism that now looms before us. One of the characteristics of a society that shatters its social bonds is, of course, the concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a tiny cabal, whether that's monarchical, fascist, communist, or in our case, corporate. Because what it does, while it leaves the facade of the republic, like the late Roman Republic, it leaves the facade of electoral politics, the facade of a free press, the facade of an independent judiciary. Behind that facade, all of the mechanisms which once made reform possible within the society are redirected to concentrating the power and accelerating the accumulation of wealth by this oligarchic elite. And statistically, you know, these figures, there's endless figures, but the New York Times recently ran actually two good pieces on what's happened to the working class. And in it, they noted that since 1973, American productivity has increased by 77%, while hourly pay has grown by 12%. And they wrote that if the federal minimum wage was tracked to productivity, it would be more than $20 an hour, not $7.25. 41.7 million American workers, that's one-third of the American workforce, earn less than $12 an hour, and almost none of them have employer-sponsored health insurance. That's a breaking of the social bond, a renting of the American myth, the idea that we are a meritocracy, that there is any kind of social mobility. So these pathologies are certainly growing as these bonds are continually broken. Labor unions have been virtually destroyed. 6% of the private sector now is unionized. The recent passage of the right to work law, which is just a further assault against union power, the ability of unions to make bargaining agreements with employers, is shattered. Cuts to all sorts of programs, punitive austerity. I mean, when I opened the book in Scranton, I went to Scranton because the city was facing bankruptcy, insolvency, and what they were doing is selling off their assets, what city assets they had, including the parking authority, the utilities, and the sewers. And of course, once corporations buy these basic services, which again are part of the communal, the social fabric of a society, they jack the rates up significantly. And the question, of course, which the mayor had, is, and we should be clear, after that 2008 crash, those city pension funds, like most cities, had lost about 40%. So the question is, what happens when there aren't any assets to sell? It's a terminal point. Karl Marx, when he writes about the late stages of capitalism, he said that what happens in the final stages of capitalism is that the unrestricted, unfettered capitalistic enterprises cannot extract the kind of profit that they want from the population, and they start to cannibalize the very structures that make a capitalist democracy possible. And that's, of course, what we're watching, not only in Scranton, but at the Department of Education. I mean, why are they privatizing education? Well, because the Department of Education has a budget of about $63 billion and the hedge funds want it. And, of course, it's also a mechanism in the hands of Betsy DeVos to get government money to, quote-unquote, Christian, let's call them what they are, Christian fascist schools. 70% of our intelligence is outsourced. Bose, Allen, Hamilton, where Edward Snowden worked, 99% of their budget comes from the U.S. government. So you're watching with the privatization of prisons. And I teach in a prison, and it's not just Corrections Corp of America or GEO Group. There, about two-thirds of undocumented people are held in private prisons. But what's really pernicious and often unreported is that within the prison system, every service has been privatized. So the food service is privatized, Aramark. The phone service, Global Tellink, is privatized, and phone rates are jacked up 4 to 5 times what they are for those on the outside. I mean, for me, this is especially disturbing because for a child who has an incarcerated parent, the telephone is usually the only line of communication. The medical services are privatized. And of course, the object is not to provide medical service or take someone to a hospital, but to make money. So the medical care deteriorates significantly. The commissaries are privatized. And this has now become a multi-billion dollar industry within the prison system. Dostoevsky said that if you want to understand the core, the heart of any society, look within their prisons. Look at what they do to the powerless and the most vulnerable. And I think that's right. I think if we want to see where the corporate state seeks to take us, we should look within the prisons. Look at what they do to the powerless. We have, of course, 25% of the world's prison population. We are 5% of the world's population. Half of the people in our prison system were never, at least in their sentencing, they were never charged with physically harming another person. Because of Bill Clinton and Joe Biden, they wanted to take back the law and order issue from the Republicans. So that's how we got the three strikes, you're outlawed. So you can spend your life in prison even though you never committed a violent crime. It's how we tripled and quadrupled the length of sentences. And it's how we expanded the prison population. About 700,000 when Clinton came to office, about 2 million when he left. And what we're seeing now is private corporations come back and use bonded labor. I just came from California. They're fighting their wildfires. A significant percentage of their firefighters are prisoners who earn $1 an hour. That's actually a lot of money. In a prison in Georgia, you can work a 40-hour week and earn nothing. But we're watching for-profit corporations now employ about 800,000 to 1 million prisoners who earn 25, 30 cents an hour. McDonald's, for instance, makes its uniforms in prison. Doesn't pay Social Security, doesn't have to pay into Social Security. These workers always show up on time. They can't complain about the working conditions. They're not paid for sick days. They're not paid any vacation time, obviously. And they can't organize. And if they're a problem, they're thrown in solitary confinement. And that is really the vision of unfettered capitalism, the creation of a new American serfdom. Now, these pathologies which have gripped our country and destroyed our democracy, you know, Ralph Nader, who I admire and have worked with for a long time, calls these global corporations traitors. He actually said, you know, deep down inside, you and I are conservatives in the classical sense of political theory because we're calling for the restoration of the rule of law. So in 2008, we saw the financial meltdown. And since then, quantitative easing has become financial policy. And the University of Missouri a few weeks ago estimated that out of electronic ether, the Fed had fabricated $26 trillion and handing this off at 0% interest or virtually 0% interest to Citibank and Goldman Sachs and everyone else. And what they did with this money is not invested in the society. They didn't create manufacturing. They didn't create jobs. They used it the way speculators use money. So they bought back their own stock. Apple bought back $100 billion worth of its own stock. And with the tax cuts, this is what's overheating the stock market. And anyone who thinks that this is a symptom of a healthy economy should go back and look at 1928. It's fictitious capital. It's not real capital. And so they're buying back their own stock. They're gambling. And the New York Times, I guess about 2 weeks ago Sunday, in the Week in Review, had a long story about the fracking industry being the next dot-com bubble crash because, as they pointed out, like the dot-com industry, the fracking industry is judged on potential profits, not actual profits. In fact, fracking is a losing venture. I think they're $280 billion in the hole or something. At what point does that house of cards come down? At what point does student debt, and it's estimated that within two decades, 40% of those who have student debt will have defaulted, $1.5 trillion, at what point does that collapse? And the danger this time is that the elites have no plan B. They can't lower interest rates any more than they've already lowered them. And what will happen? Alfred McCoy, in his book Shadows of American Century, posits that by 2030, the American empire will implode. I just spent a reporter too long to play Nostradamus with dates, but that we're moving close to that denouement is certain. And what will implode it is when the dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency. So all of the characteristics of late empire, essentially a mafia economy morphs into a mafia state. It opens a space because of that enemy for demagogues like Trump. And however imbecilic and narcissistic and crude Trump is, he rose to power by insulting, often in very vulgar ways, the elites, the Bushes, the Clintons, who have betrayed, especially the white working class, and by telling people what they want to hear. What happens in late empire is that empires make or stumble into military fiascos. The Soviet Union in Afghanistan, for the classicists, it would be the Athenian Empire invading Sicily. Their entire fleet is sunk. Thousands of their soldiers are killed. The empire disintegrates. Or 1956, when the British invade Egypt after Nasser nationalizes the Suez Canal, and then the British have to retreat in humiliation. Shortly after that, the pound sterling is dropped as the world's reserve currency, and the British economy goes into a tailspin. So at that moment, the empire immediately has to contract because it can't maintain the massive bloated military machine that it has, some 600 bases overseas. Imports become very expensive, and then you flirt with the danger, of course, of hyperinflation. I've lived through three hyperinflations, Argentina, Nicaragua, and Yugoslavia. And when you get hyperinflation across the political spectrum, you lose complete confidence in the ruling system. The whole kind of any sense of stability is shattered. And out of that economic crisis, then the monsters really come out. The pathologies were all there before, of course. And we live in a moment now of relative stability. But at that crisis, you lack the foundations and the social bonds and even the rituals that give you any kind of cohesion. One of the consequences of a decayed society, because societies, when they decay physically, decay morally. And I have a whole chapter on sexual sadism, which, for instance, was very much a part of the late Roman Empire. And I write that chapter out of a place called kink.com in San Francisco, which is the largest BDSM operation in the world. They will live stream a torture. Torture is the word they use, by the way, of women who are waterboarded and you can call in. And this is, you know, we live in a pornified society. It's not that whole kind of objectification of human beings is part of the disease of a capitalist society where everything is commodified, including the natural world, which is then exploited until exhaustion or collapse. So how do we respond? We have seen the Democratic Party, in particular under Bill Clinton, sell out to corporate power, NAFTA. And, I wrote a chapter out of Anderson, Indiana. Anderson was a city that used to be a huge center for GM. 25,000 union jobs, $25 or $30 an hour, pensions, benefits, job protection, union security, and then Clinton signs NAFTA, and by 2006, all of those plants are gone. They're in Monterrey, Mexico, where GM pays workers $3 an hour without benefits. Rather than leave the plants abandoned, they actually bulldoze them. These are these huge weed-choked lots. And Anderson has fallen into the kind of decay that many of our deindustrialized cities have fallen into, with all of the attendant problems of opioids and suicides and everything else. And what was fascinating is that those old UAW workers, they voted for Sanders in the primary, but they voted for Trump in the election. And I'm not denying the inherent racism that Trump espouses, that Stephen Miller espouses, Bannon, all of that, all around him, and many of his supporters. But it's not simply racism. There's something deeper going on. There's a betrayal. And I hold the Democratic Party particularly culpable because they, figures like Clinton and Obama, continued to speak as if they were defending the interests of working men and women while they betrayed them. And that was particularly egregious. They were sold out, and they were sold out. I mean, you look at the swath of destruction that Clinton made. He deregulated the FCC, so a half dozen corporations control what 90% of Americans watch or listen to. I mean, the other thing is this whole thing about Russiagate and fake news. Yeah, we got fake news. It's called Fox News. No, it's really frightening. I come out of the old dark ages of American journalism. The whole idea that Fox is considered a legitimate news organization. And then the hyperventilating on CNN. It's all about revenue streams. They don't do journalism anymore. I mean, Stormy Daniels and Stormy Daniels' lawyer wants to run for president, and Omarosa and, you know, whatever idiotic thing Trump tweeted, but it's all court gossip. You know, it's like Versailles, and everybody's wondering which mistress Louis XIV dragged into the bedchamber tonight. But while the real world, the world that occupies most Americans, is invisible. I mean, the press has such low credibility in terms of polling, and they deserve it. I mean, Trump is a creation of the media. He's a creation of NBC. I mean, everybody who did The Apprentice knew that he was a disaster as a developer, multiple bankruptcies, defrauded his investors, cheated his contractors, many of whom went into bankruptcy. And they create this fictional persona, which he then sells to be president. But it doesn't end there. CNN can't let it go. They are complicit in this whole gigantic reality television narrative because it makes them money. CNN made more money last year, $1 billion, than they've ever made. So this burlesque is hardly limited to Trump. In fact, the commercial media is an enabler. And my great fear as we come closer and closer to another economic collapse, which is inevitable, and this isn't even a controversial opinion anymore. It's just a question of when and how bad. In the New York Times, and I do read other publications beside the Times, about 10 days ago had quite a scathing editorial about standing on the precipice, the economic precipice. And my fear is that the longer we are self-deluded, the longer we fail to confront how diseased our society is, how dysfunctional our democracy has become, the more we will empower these very dark undercurrents of American society, which have always been with us, but are now proliferating in this kind of anomie that has spread out across the American landscape. And that means that those of us who care about an open society, who care that 16 million children are going to bed hungry every night, who care about the reigns of police terror in our inner cities, and terror is not an exaggerated term, who care about the suffering of our young who are burdened by debts they can never repay and can find no place for them in the economy other than menial and demeaning low-wage jobs, had better begin to make sure our voices are heard through a series of nonviolent acts of sustained mass civil disobedience, such as we saw in Standing Rock. And if we can get out and get out soon, and we haven't even spoken about climate change, because these people are not just flirting with the destruction of empire, But now with the destruction of the biosphere that sustains the human species, and their mania for short-term profit means that at this point there are no internal or external constraints to stop them from this predatory and ultimately self-destructive behavior. I watched what crowds of tens of thousands of people can do in Eastern Europe. I covered the revolution in East Germany, in Czechoslovakia, and Romania. And I was in Alexanderplatz, in East Berlin, with 500,000 East Germans as they nonviolently brought down the Stasi state, the most sophisticated security and surveillance state in human history until our own. We have that power if we are willing to harness it to another vision, one that is socialist, where we look back to the Scandinavian countries of the 1970s, where everyone had a decent income. Yes, taxes were high. There were no homeless. Mentally ill people were not thrown on the streets. 25% of our prison population is severely mentally ill. A senior public school teacher earned as much as a doctor. This is the kind of society I want to live in, the kind of society that I believe is worth fighting for. And I think that at this point, it's incumbent upon us to face the forces of radical evil before us and resist. I'm a parent, I'm not the only parent in this room, and we are responsible for the world our children inherit. And even if we fail, given what's coming, I want my children to at least say he tried. I don't know if we will succeed. I don't even know if we will survive as a species. But these corporate forces have us by the throat, and they have my children by the throat. And in the end, I don't fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. Thank you.
Thanks. Hey, you talked about a lot of problems. I kind of feel like there is this knot, and I don't know where to pull first. So I wonder if you have a thought about where to pull first.
Fracking's a huge issue in Colorado. I think every community, you don't have to walk too many blocks from your house to see it. ICE, the prison complex, the fracking industry, and we can't fight every battle, but we have to pick a battle. So I don't think there's any shortage. I think, as you said, in some ways it's so overwhelming. The fight for minimum wage. I just think there's on so many fronts that we can invest ourselves, but we have to invest.
Thank you so much. In fact, with that in mind, I wanted to ask a question about women in politics and women in decision making, whether it's in the corporate world, in the boardroom, and also currently, I think it's if women who are now running for Congress are elected or continue to serve, I think it'll be 37% of the Democratic Party will be reflected with the face of women. And with the support of men. In countries around the world like Rwanda and in the Scandinavian countries, those percentages are more than 50% now. And what the economist will say is when more women are in government, enough to make a difference or a balance with men, they will shift government monies away from weapons, tanks, warfare, in the direction of education, healthcare, infrastructure and the eradication of poverty. So my question is, have you studied the role of women in decision-making in corporate and politics?
Well, you mean like Margaret Thatcher? I mean, the whole idea that...
Let's say I call Margaret Thatcher a man in a skirt.
No, she was a woman.
Because she had to fit in order to rise.
Right, but the whole idea that a particular gender or race, I mean, we live in a system that's so corrupted. You can't attain political power without massive amounts of corporate money. This is part of the problem of our system. It's a system of legalized bribery. And so they select who they want. And many of these Democratic candidates, including women, are coming out of the military, the intelligence community. Their positions are often ones that, like Hillary Clinton, embrace empire. When I heard Hillary Clinton run around talking about caring about women and children, I thought, well, it was Bill Clinton who destroyed our old welfare system, and 70% of the original recipients were children. This is just a fallacy, and I think that gets into identity politics. I mean, there's a huge difference between Rosa Luxemburg, who I admire, and Condoleezza Rice. And I think that we can't be naive that those women or people of color who are pushed forward, like Barack Obama, who was vetted and approved by the Chicago political machine, the dirtiest in the country, have essentially promised to be loyal to that agenda. So I agree with you that we need more people of color, we need more women within our system, without question. But that's not enough. What is it that they are standing for? And I think too often we buy into this branding, and that's what Obama was. He was a brand. And advertising age, when he was elected, gave him his top annual award, which was Marketer of the Year, because they knew very well what he had done. And there was a mandate that Obama was given, and he turned right around and embraced Larry Summers. So it's not enough. And I think we have to get beyond that. I think we have to embrace people who, and preferably people of color, and preferably women, but they have to come with this radical agenda. It's not enough that they come out of a particular ethnic or gender group.
Thank you, Chris. I've been following your writings and work, and thank you for being a voice for the voiceless. I'm from Iran. I'm a human rights and social and whatever activist, environmental activist. I was at Standing Rock. I was part of also Wall Street, the Occupy. Right now, I want to ask you to speak to two things, please. One is Iran, because right now, the you-know-whos are trying to find a pretext to attack Iran. And there are inside Iran forces that are, unfortunately, too... In the words of Dr. Mossadegh was Iran's prime minister who was overthrown by the CIA in 1953, as I'm sure you know, that he said internal despotism and external colonialism are two sides of the same coin. So we have in Iran right now internal despot and external colonial power needing each other as enemy. So please speak to that. The other thing, please speak to Islamophobia, which has nothing to do with reforming Islam. I'm a Sufi monk, I'm a dervish. And Islamophobia as a political project. Please speak to these
right,
people.
So why are they demonizing Iran? Well, they're demonizing Iran because in the last 17 years they've made a total mess of the Middle East. They've destroyed Iraq as a unified country. In Afghanistan, the Taliban controls more territory than when we went in 17 years ago. Syria is a mess, largely because we sent in hundreds of millions of weapons, much of it diverted from Libyan arsenals, where we created another failed state. The breakdown of these cohesion saw the rise of numerous jihadist groups, which have carried out suicide attacks in particularly in Europe, quite large ones. And they don't know how to get out. They don't know how to extract themselves from this endless war, from the military fiasco. Historians call it micromilitarism, that final act of empire. And so what they are seeking to do is demonize Iran as if it's Iran's fault, which doesn't even make any sense because the greatest enemy of the Taliban are the Iranians. It's a kind of desperate gambit. And it also will ensure that the arms manufacturers, who are the only people who are profiting from our debacle in the Middle East, will continue to make money. So that's Iran. And then as far as Islamophobia, again, it's about demonizing a particular group to cover up for your own failure. I mean, what happens in disintegrating societies, and this is what I fear, you know, when we have another economic crisis, is that you have these demagogues like Trump. We already see the rhetoric of Trump is already inciting violence. But you see these demagogues channel this inchoate rage towards the vulnerable, as if 11 million undocumented workers are responsible for the economic decline of America. It's just patently absurd, but it works. Unfortunately, I watched it in Yugoslavia. You demonize Muslims, you demonize African Americans, you demonize feminists, intellectuals. The Christian right already has the list written up. And you green light these hate groups. And for the book, I spent a time with hate groups because hate groups always arise from disintegrating societies. At one point, I was in a wooded area outside of Binghamton, New York, around a bonfire at night with the alt-right, the Proud Boys, and the Three Percenters praying to my Presbyterian God that none of them would Google me. But that's very much part of a collapsed society. So in both cases, they're looking for scapegoats.
Thank you. It's good to see you again after the Stop the Frack Attack conference back in 2015 in Denver. I have a question for you that is specifically about this November. And here in Colorado, we're introducing a ballot initiative that we introduced back in 2016 and it failed, and it was to abolish slavery. We found that there were two reasons that we think that it failed. One was that the language on the ballot was really confusing. This year it's going to be much simpler language, so we think that's going to clear up a lot. But the other thing was that it was highly undervoted on. Between the minimum wage campaign and our campaign, we lost 166,000 voters who just didn't fill it out. They left it blank. So my question for you is, first of all, we'd love to have your endorsement on the campaign. And second of all, what advice would you have to encourage people in a state like Colorado where the ballot can be very long and very tedious to fill out? We have the luxury of doing it at home, but at the same time, it does take quite a bit of time to research everything. What would you say to encourage voters to vote the entire ballot and specifically vote yes on Amendment A?
Are you talking about slavery within the prison system?
So it's not a policy thing, it's a constitutional thing, so I can say what I think.
Well, the 13th Amendment legalizes slavery in the prison system.
And this mirrors the 13th Amendment. So what is in the current Colorado Constitution mirrors the 13th Amendment.
Right. I mean, I can't speak specifically to that issue because I'm not familiar with it, but in terms of fighting the system of slavery within the prison system, we just saw very heroic acts of civil disobedience by thousands of incarcerated men and women that ended September 9th, the anniversary of the 1971 Attica prison uprising. And they carried out work stoppages, commissary boycotts, and even hunger strikes. And I think that the rationale behind their resistance was correct, and that they said going the route of legislation is useless. We just don't have lobbyists. We don't have money. Our legislators are bought and sold, both in Washington and in the state houses. The only way, in their words, to stop slavery is to stop being a slave. Because if we had to pay the minimum wage for work in the prison, remember, every job in a prison is done by a prisoner. I mean, when the prison where I work, I come in past the guard's barber shop, and there are prisoners literally in barber uniforms. If they paid the minimum wage, the system would collapse because it's built on the ability to extract profit from underpaid or unpaid labor. And this is a continuum in American history that goes all the way back to slavery, convict leasing, the black codes, lynching. It's protean. It just keeps changing its face. And in terms of combating, I think, the most egregious form of slavery, which is what's happening to 2.3 million of our own citizens, it is by, on the outside, working with those on the inside who are willing to rise up. And I can tell you, rising up within a prison takes tremendous amounts of courage because they can't escape. I was in Missouri, so I teach in a prison. I've taught for 10 years. I just taught last semester, I taught Les Miserables. But I was teaching a course called Conquest, and we read Open Veins of Latin America, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and C.L.R. James's Black Jacobins on the Haitian slave revolt, the only successful slave revolt in human history, and Haiti's been paying for it ever since. And I gave my students a syllabus and said, well, I won't be here this week because I'm speaking in Montana. And I was in my hotel room in Montana, and I got a phone call, and they said, this is the Special Investigations Division of the Department of Corrections of the state of New Jersey. Do you know your students just led a sit-down strike in the prison? And when I got off that phone, I just wept. Because how many of us under those conditions would have the courage to rise up? And they knew exactly what was going to happen. And it did happen. All of their cells were strip searched. Everyone was interrogated because they have to find the leaders. And whatever little you have in prison, your chance to go to class, your job, your rec time, they threatened to take away. And they found the leaders, and they shipped them to another prison and put them in indefinite solitary confinement, along with the 80,000 Americans who at this moment are in solitary confinement, which is a form of torture. And they stood up anyway. And for me, that's so empowering, because they grasp that that resistance, that act of resistance, was in many ways the only freedom they would have. And I think I find within that prison system, because they understand the judiciary, because they understand institutional racism, because they understand what it means to create mini police states for the poor, their political sophistication is one that we should all look to and emulate. And we need to marry ourselves to that kind of radicalism if we have any hope of saving our country. Thank you.